How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. I am on my own this week. Kimberly Tay will not be hosting today because she is very tied up in schoolwork, but you can look forward to hearing from the two of us sometime soon. In the meantime, I will fill up the absence here with a couple of interviews. Today's show is going to be focused around how to organize a sustainable movement. The feature interview is with David Cadman, and we'll be looking at the role of cities in the world sustainable movement. And then I also had an interview with Jamie from 350.org, a new website that's being put together to mobilize people in sustainability. So the theme of the day is how to get an effective world sustainable movement going. So first off is an interview with David Cadman. So this is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures, and we have David Cadman on the line, who is a counselor for the City of Vancouver and much, much more. Involved, very, very involved with a lot of initiatives with sustainability. Director of International Association of Peace Messenger Cities, Director of Mayors of Campaign for Climate Change, Representative Local Government of the United Nations Commission on Sustainable Development, and a whole list. Where does this interest come from?
Well, I worked overseas many times in my life, one time for 4.5 years. And when I came back to Canada, I've always been involved. I used to work with the United Nations Association, was the national president of Canada of that, and then was the international vice president. And I've always believed of acting locally but thinking globally.
Mm-hmm.
And more now, you have to do both. You have to think locally and act globally.
Right. Okay. So, being so active in this, what's your impression of how things are going?
Well, I'm very positive on what ICLEI, the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, of which I'm the international president, is doing. It's a grouping of, well, arguably somewhere in the order of 2,000 to 3,000 cities that are working together on issues of sustainability. So we have one group that's working on climate change. The meeting in Bali that just took place, the COP, the meeting of the parties, cities represented the second largest delegation after the Indonesian delegation itself. And in fact, if you included the cities that were part of the Indonesian delegation, we had the largest delegation there. And we were there because we're saying cities represent now 50% of the world's population. By 2050, they will represent two-thirds of the world's population. They're currently responsible for 75% of the air CO2 emissions and 80% of the energy consumption. So we're basically going into these international forums and saying national governments are meeting, but if we're going to solve this problem, it's going to be at the local city level. We're going to have to change the way in which cities work. And we're going to have to change both the built environment and make it much, much more efficient than it's been built. And we're going to have to change the mobile environment and emphasize pedestrians, cycling, public transit. and public transit not run by fossil fuel. And that's essentially going to mean phasing out the automobile, or at least shifting the automobile into a much smaller, lighter vehicle that can run on solar electric.
Is it difficult to get all these cities involved, or are they generally ready to, just jump on?
Most of the cities that join the Cities for Climate Protection campaign agree to reduce their emissions 20% below 1990, whereas the Kyoto Protocol requires 6% below 1990. And we've got cities that are participating from all over the world. Cities get it. They understand that many are on the coast, and that the kinds of climate change that we're going to see are going to involve rising coastal waters. And that means that they are either going to spend a great deal of money to try and protect themselves from those rising seas, probably unsuccessfully, or we have to change this. What's happening right now in the Arctic is absolutely startling. We've gone from a situation where 40% of the ice had melted, so you have all of a sudden a white reflective surface, which reflects 90% of the energy, to a blue absorptive surface that absorbs 90% of the energy. We're now seeing the Northwest Passage open all year long. And this is profound change. And the more startling thing that's occurring is not only is the ice melting, but the tundra's melting. And if the tundra melts in Canada, Northern Europe, and Russia, we will see a massive release of methane gas. And methane gas is 23 times more potent in terms of a climate change gas than CO2 emissions. So we are at the point right now where cities absolutely get it, that they need to transform the way in which they function. But they also know that they can't do it alone. A city in Canada, for example, 80% of Canadians live in cities, and yet a city in Canada gets 8 cents of the tax revenue. The provincial government gets 42 cents, the national government gets 50 cents. So we're trying to deal with 80% of the people's issues with 8% of the revenues. And simply put, we can't do it. And so we need assistance. I used to chair the finance committee of TransLink, and we don't have the capital to invest in public transit. So right now, we have people who want to take public transit, but basically can't get on because it's too crowded, because we're 600 to 800 buses behind where we ought to be at acquisition, and we're many, many years behind when we said we would complete a network of rapid transit, either surface or, in the case of the Canada Line, underground, or in the case of SkyTrain, elevated. So we need to get additional assistance from the senior levels of government in order to put the option out there so that people really can get out of their cars. And we need much better building codes so that we make sure that buildings are built efficiently, but are built with an optic of saying, instead of building and just assuming that you're going to plug into the electric grid or plug into the water supply or plug into the sewer system, we need to make those buildings and the neighborhoods that surround them much more efficient. We know what we can do with geothermal.
Okay. Would that be just to safeguard against big outages or catastrophes?
Well, no, because what it really is trying to do is trying to say if we can absolutely make our cities less dependent on energy supplies, then we don't have to grow constantly energy. And a place like China is building literally a coal-fired energy plant every single week. And so China is very much, they're very much from Missouri. They're from the show me country. They say, don't tell me what to do, show me what to do. And so we need to begin to demonstrate to the Chinese, who have a rapid rate of growth, how efficient we can be in making our cities less dependent on a grid system that draws energy from elsewhere. And, you know, I talked to the mayor of Shanghai, and he says, well, look, Every single year, I have 500,000 people who arrive in my city. Mm-hmm. I have to build housing for them. I have to build schools. I have to build medical facilities. I have to find electricity capacity. I have to find water capacity. I have to find sewage capacity. I have to find waste disposal capacity. All of these things beg for a 21st century revolution in the way in which cities function. And mm-hmm. there are excellent models out there that we can learn from. And that's what ICLEI really is. It's a learning network where cities learn how to do things differently.
Right. That's ICLEI, is it?
Yeah, the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, Local Governments for Sustainability.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we're now a player at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. We're a player in the UN Framework Convention on Biodiversity. We're a player in the OECD. We are beginning to exercise our muscle as cities to say we're sick and tired of national governments not finding solutions and us having to deal with the consequences of that. And you need only look around the world this week to see that there are floods everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There are growing hurricanes everywhere. When the Gulf of Mexico gets 1 degree centigrade warmer, its absorptive capacity of water and its brewing of storms increases phenomenally, which means that when those storms touch down, they wreak damage where people live, and most people live in cities.
Mm-hmm. In cities, they're often on the coast.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you find there's as far as a city's needs goes worldwide, are there a lot of differences, or what are some similarities? What are some differences?
Obviously, you've got a little bit of a north-south divide, in the sense that if you're talking about a city in Africa, their capacity to deal with these issues is overwhelming. I mean, mm-hmm. the areas that I knew in Africa that used to have 60,000 people today have 2 million living in slums.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is staggering. To imagine to be in a city trying to solve a problem when you've got 2 million people living in a squatter village with very little water, very little sanitation.
Right, they're just worried about surviving day to day.
Exactly. So the capacity is very different.
Mm-hmm.
We have the capacity, but we don't seem to have the coordination on a national level. And I point to, in 1973, when we had a spike in oil and gas prices, a lot of people moved into smaller, more efficient vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are 25 years later, and the prestige vehicle is the Hummer and the SUV. We have learned nothing, and yet the reality is that oil and gas is a finite resource, and it's going to get more and more and more expensive. The ability of us all to drive cars is going to change, and yet we don't have the options in place for the people that have to get around,
mm-hmm.
And going the places where they need to go. And that's where we need the senior levels of government. Senior levels of government, put money into twinning the Portman Bridge and widening the highway, but they don't put sufficient resources into public transit. And that's where we need to be focused right now. Not a single dollar should go into expansion of roads, because roads are going to go the way of the dinosaur. Unless we get a very efficient electric vehicle, a plug-in electric, that we can charge from solar panels, the idea that we're going to be able to run around in a fuel-based vehicle, it's simply going to cost too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's not going to work whether you want to, if you're going to try and make it work or not. It's simply just not going to work.
And unfortunately, what we do is we assume that tomorrow is going to be a continuum of today.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to go through some stark realizations that the world is changing and we have to change. And we cannot simply deplete our energy resources and then assume that somebody will figure out a hydrogen vehicle or whatever. We have to begin to make those transformations as cities today and build more compact, build more energy efficient, build, yes, less water demanding, build less waste disposal demanding, and build more cities that are much more pedestrian, cycle, and public transit friendly.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is an interview with David Cadman. How does a meeting work, or like with 2,000 to 3,000 cities full of busy people? How does an organization like this work?
Well, we have some 20 offices around the world. Mm-hmm. That are working with the cities in their region.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes offices in India, offices in Indonesia, okay. Offices in the Philippines, offices in Korea, offices in Japan, offices in Europe, etc. So that's the first thing that we have, is we have a real working with cities. And then what we do is we try and take examples of what cities are doing and share it with other cities. And let me give you an example. We've always operated in Vancouver on the premise that you don't want garburators. You don't want to take your organics and grind them up and put them into the sewer system.
Mm-hmm.
Sweden is operating on Stockholm is operating on a very different premise. They want their organics in the sewer system because they extract methane from their sewer system that is now running many of their civic vehicles. So for them, rather than having trucks going around and picking up organics, they're having their organics flow through the sewer system, get to a facility that draws off the gas and fuels their vehicles.
Uh-huh.
Another example, Santa Rosa, California. Normally, when you have a sewage system, you want to make sure that you prevent algae growth in there. Santa Rosa is now experimenting with a system that says, no, let's incur algae growth. Let's then algae doubles its mass about every 2 days. So what they're doing is then converting their sewage into algae and converting their algae into ethanol.
Uh-huh.
So you don't have then a disposal issue.
Yeah.
And so all of these things are new. And, we know what we can do with geothermal. We know that really there's no need to heat a building off of energy when, by simply putting a hole deep enough into the ground, you can effectively extract cool air in the summer from down below the ground and warm air in the winter from beneath the ground and use the Earth's natural cycle to heat and cool your buildings. But what's interesting now is down at Falls Creek for the Olympic Village, Vancouver's experimenting with drawing heat off the sewage system and converting that heat into a capacity to heat buildings.
Uh-huh.
All of these experiments that are being done in cities are being shared with each other.
Right.
And I think that's where we can absolutely learn and begin to transform the way in which our cities function by learning from one another. And I mean, I go to a lot of meetings. I go to the Union of BC Municipalities. I go to the Canadian Federation of Municipalities. But the meetings of ICLEI, for me, are the ones where people are really sparking off of each other because they're each describing what they're doing. What Paris has done right now with bicycles, where you swipe a credit card and you can take a bicycle and use it, and as long as you return it within half an hour to another lockup, you pay nothing for it. And if you use it a little bit longer, well, you pay a small charge on your credit card, is totally revolutionizing the way in which Parisians, who take the public transit system often but want then to move around a little bit, can move around their cities. those kinds of experiments, the kind of experiments that are being done in Holland, the kind of experiments that are being done in Copenhagen. Copenhagen wants to go to 50 to 60% of their public moving by bicycle. They're 40% now.
Wow.
They've already gone to 22% of their energy generated by wind. They want to go to 50%, and they'll get there. And the interesting thing is, in so doing, Denmark has captured the wind generator market. Germany has basically said, look, we will pay anybody who puts solar electric capacity onto their building. We will pay them, if they feed it into the grid, not what they buy energy for, but what we would have to pay replacement energy.
I find that one very interesting because Germany is a rainy country, is it not?
It is.
And they're the ones that are taking the lead on using the solar energy.
Yeah,
so.
But, you know, there have been studies done in the United States. The city that has the most precipitation is Seattle. And yet, if you were simply to use the southern exposure of roofs and the southern wall of buildings, Seattle generates enough energy, in fact, it generates more than enough energy to satisfy household demand.
Yeah.
And the exciting news here is that China now has got a company that's in the process of producing...
I saw that, yes.
...solar energy.
Yeah.
Once the Chinese start to produce it, the unit cost of buying solar energy will plummet. And that will make it much more competitive with oil and gas. And then what we have to do is figure out how we build enough incentive for people to actually take up the options to put solar onto their houses and defer the demand for a site C dam or a coal-fired generator or more oil and gas exploration. And the countries and the companies that move there quickly are going to be the ones that capture the market.
Yeah, I guess there's like a critical point where all of a sudden the market is good.
There's a price point.
Price point, yes.
At which buying solar capacity relative to the cost of using energy. I mean, we've got to say that here in British Columbia, we are spoiled. We have hydroelectric energy that was built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which is very cheap. And so it dissuades people from putting in alternatives. And what we need to do is say, well, okay, but hang on. If we're going to build a Site C, if we're going to put in a coal-fired generator, what's that going to cost? And wouldn't it be smarter if we got individuals to put in solar capacity so that we never, ever have to build that additional capacity?
Okay. And I guess you're speaking from the perspective of municipalities, and I just want to ask, so far you've mentioned geothermal and solar. Are those the best for a municipal kind of situation?
Well, I've mentioned geothermal, which is definitely very good. I've mentioned solar, which is very, very good. I've also mentioned the idea of extracting heat from sewer.
Right, yes.
To heat a neighborhood. And, I mean, there are some communities that basically say, look, if what we do is keep the water in the sewers hot by using simply a hot water system that adds hot water to the sewer, we could in fact use the sewers as which run everywhere in a city as an ability to extract heat from those sewers and heat homes. And there's a lot of wasted heat in society. I mean, you go to your average grocery store and all of their cooling units, etc., generate enormous heat that could be, in fact, instead of funneled into the air, funneled into the sewer system to keep that system continually warm so that it could, in fact, be a heating system for the entire city. And these are the things that we need to begin to look at in the 21st century, is a city that is not dependent on a power grid from outside, but certainly for its heating, by the efficiency of the building and the geothermal, the solar, the hot water circulating in sewer, gives the capacity of actually heating that city without external energy.
What is peace messenger cities?
The peace in 1986, it was International Year of Peace.
Uh-huh.
And the United Nations decided that they wanted to recognize cities which were actually contributing to the peace process. And that was the year where this city, when it was, we were celebrating our 100th anniversary,
uh-huh.
and we asked the citizens, what do we want to do to celebrate our 100th anniversary? And they unanimously came back and said, do something for peace. And so we invited people from all over the world who were major thinkers on nuclear disarmament, on ridding us of weapons of mass destruction, mm-hmm. be they chemical or biological, of making peace where war now rages. And we held this conference, and we're named one of the peace messenger cities. And what happened is the cities then got together and said, look, we have the capacity in times of war to communicate with one another, to basically try and make sure that though our governments may not be talking,
yes.
we in cities who will be the recipient of the bombs and will suffer the consequences of war, whether it's an actual destruction or massive refugees coming into our jurisdiction, we need to keep on talking.
Mm-hmm.
We need to find ways. So, for example, what we did, not last year, but the year before last, was we focused on Yugoslavia. We knew that Kosovo was going to be a very, very timely issue for Yugoslavia. So we brought together people from Montenegro, from Croatia, from Serbia, from Kosovo, from Macedonia. And we had a very, very frank discussion where we said, look, your cities are the largest population base in each of your countries. It is you that are going to get bombed. It is you that are going to have to welcome the refugees. So we basically got them to the point where they said, yeah, you're right. We have to take a much more active and preemptive role here.
Mm-hmm.
We've worked very closely with the Mayors for Peace, some 3,000 of them around the world who signed on to the Hiroshima Declaration that basically says no more nuclear weapons. This is a weapon whose time has passed.
Uh-huh.
It's not, war used to be a war between armies.
Yeah.
Now what war has become is a war on civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And cities understand that not only will their infrastructure be destroyed, and not only will their people suffer, but then they'll have massive in-migration of people who have no capacity to be settled, who simply have to get out of a war zone.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to work together, and we're trying to work at the United Nations, we're trying to work with our national governments to say, we've got to find alternatives, folks. We cannot continue to put our resources. The Canadian government has just made a commitment to spend $500 million, $500 million on weapons. Now, most Canadians would say, well, geez, we've got huge homelessness. We've got all sorts of other problems. Why are we putting money into this?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kinds of discussions that we have within the peace messenger community.
How does it become so different, the perspective of a province or a state versus that of a city? Why are there so many differences?
Well, I think the difference is because what we deal with is immediate. We deal with citizens who are right there in our face talking to us.
Yeah.
And they say, I'm not happy when I go down to the downtown east side and see massive homelessness and drug addiction and mental illness. Whereas to get that message through to Ottawa and Victoria,
uh-huh.
it's much more remote. Nobody is in their face talking to them about these issues. And they play this little game of not my jurisdiction shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... You can't play that at a city level because ultimately the problems are there and they're yours. And They may be the responsibility of the senior level of government, but fundamentally, they are on your streets and you have to solve them.
Right. So there's a lot of barriers in policy to a city, it sounds like.
Well, there are lots of barriers, sure, because we don't have the resources, and in many cases, we don't have the jurisdiction. I mean, mental illness. When they closed Riverview and said, you know, the idea is we're going to have these people housed closer to home, great idea, but nobody then did anything about it. And so all of a sudden, we had all these people flowing out of Riverview with no capacity to support themselves, and they go to a place where they know there's a distribution of food and there's shelters and places like that, and all of a sudden we've got a huge street problem. And then those same people fall prey to drug peddlers, and they then become dual diagnosed. They've got a mental illness and they've got a drug addiction, and they're on our streets. Mm-hmm. And the federal government says, not our problem, it's health. And the provincial government says, well, not our problem, housing is a federal jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this convenient shuffle. But, I mean, if you look at how we're spending money, we're spending a lot of money on things that I think most people would say doesn't solve the problems where they live. And I think more and more people want the resources of government to solve the problems where we live. You know, again, you can see the polls right now on the whole issue of Afghanistan. I think most Canadians would say, well, why are we in Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
What is Afghanistan's relationship to us? We've gone in there, and yet drug production has quadrupled in Afghanistan. Those are the same drugs that are on our streets and going into people's arms. And so, not only is the flow increasing, but the consequences for cities is increasing. And rather than dealing with the problem, we're off. I mean, anyone who knows anything about Afghanistan knows that it's a very tribal place. You've got literally valleys which are controlled by different tribal chieftains.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the idea somehow that we're going to bring democracy to Afghanistan, I think people are now beginning to understand we've been totally misled by our political leaders. This is not going to happen. What you've got now is you've got somebody who is in Kabul who controls none of the hinterland, and the hinterland is growing poppies. Those same poppies are funding the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, I mean, my solution to it, go and buy up the entire poppy crop. Buy it. You know, give the farmers money for the crop, but take it out of the criminal economy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a shortage of opiates on the world market right now anyway, so you can convert that into medicinal purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously take away the resources that are fueling the Taliban, that are giving money to the Taliban, that allow them to then shoot at the soldiers that have been sent over there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think somehow we've got to be a lot more creative and really work on the fundamentals at home. I'm not saying don't work on international issues. We have to contribute. We're a wealthy country. We have the capacity to contribute, but I don't think war ever solves a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think very often it creates, in many cultures, a blood feud, where somebody says, you know, my uncle was shot by the Canadians, I have to revenge that killing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a vicious, vicious cycle that does nobody any good.
Yeah, I think a lot of this seems to be people are used to the regular way of things, way of dealing with problems and solving. And I think the example of the sewer system is great because it's just a simple shift, looking outside of the normal sphere of thinking, and there's easy solutions there. I'm finding a pattern in this conversation of that type. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah,
that?
Very much so.
Yes.
I'm not saying it's easy, because any time that you have...
Yes, because you need a whole new infrastructure and everything.
The idea, the shift that it takes to make that infrastructure work in a different way takes creativity. And unfortunately, we don't train people for that. I mean, I'll give an example. There was a survey done of architectural schools in North America, and not one single architectural school has a sustainable building design course within its program, much less a program that one could graduate as a sustainable architect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what that says to me is that we're basically training people in the same way that we trained them in the 1950s, but the world has changed.
Mm-hmm.
We need to begin to look at those kinds of profound shifts that allow us to train young people to be the creative elements of change in the future, instead of assuming that tomorrow is a continuum of today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. So I guess I want to go into cities again, and what has the experience been so far? What is the power of a city? Has a city been able to defy provincial decisions and actually force the provincial bodies to change their mind?
You know, I think there's two ways of approaching this. One is to say, let's put all of our energy into changing the senior levels of government, and I think that's futile. And the other way is simply to do things.
Yeah.
And what more and more cities are doing is simply saying, I don't have the energy to try and convert my state, my province, my national government. What I have the energy to do...
Hello? Hello?
Hoping that by demonstrating it, senior governments will come along and understand that it's in their interest to have cities make these kinds of efficiency conversions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is what's happening. I look at a city like Freiburg that is in Germany that has basically created the interior of their city is entirely pedestrian and cycle. Cars don't come in. I look at a city like Amsterdam, and again, cars are the exception. It's public transit, bicycles, and walking. And so cities are beginning to design themselves for the 21st century, and slowly but surely, people who visit these cities understand how convenient, how comfortable, how this works.
And it makes you happier, too.
It does. It does. I mean, the quality of life is so much better. And interestingly enough, what Freiburg said is they wanted to build a city where children could go outside their homes and be safe, mm-hmm. and the major threat to their safety was cars.
Yes.
So they said, get the cars out of downtown. And they've done it. I mean, what London has done with the surcharge for people coming into downtown has relieved congestion. So people are doing things... What was done with the Thames gates, when Ken Livingstone built the gates that could be dropped down on the Thames to prevent storm surges coming up to the Thames and flooding the city,
mm-hmm.
at the time it was looked upon as a folly, an expenditure that was folly. It has saved London from 17 floods. So all of these things now are things that cities are doing because they get it. And what needs to happen is the political base that cities represent in nations now need to begin to hear that more and more and more people are living in cities, and the cities are going to be the places where innovation and change and creativity makes life better for our citizens. Get on board, put the resources in, work with us, don't work against us.
Okay.
The building codes, classic example. We have a building code that is really in the 1950s. We need to really change that building code emphasize energy, water, and waste efficiency. We can do it. It's not rocket science. It's quite simple.
Mm-hmm. Well, excellent. I'm really happy to have had your time today, David Cadman. It's been an honor. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us on Sustainable Futures.
Pleasure, anytime.
Okay, and I wish you a great day.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it. That was our first interview. It was with David Cadman. I feel extremely honored to have had him, as I guess a recorded version of myself had just said, because I've been following, of course, sustainability for quite some time, and his name has been surrounded by all kinds of things that I've felt to be on the leading edge of what I consider to be the best ideas in sustainability. So, quite an honor for me for that interview. And now we have Jamie from 350.org, and to speak of the leading edge, well, this is about a website that's only a month old. It is www.350.org, the number 350, and you'll soon see what is so significant about that number. Here is an interview with Jamie from 350.org. This is Ryan of Sustainable Futures with Jamie from 350.org, and we'll be doing an interview today about the organization. First of all, Jamie, thank you for being a guest here on Sustainable Futures.
Thanks and for having me.
What is the significance of the number 350?
Well, we're making the argument that 350 is one of the most important numbers in the world, and the reason why is because it represents the safe level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the safe upper limit, which is 350 parts per million. So that 350 number is the target that the whole world needs to be shooting for in order to stop global warming.
So parts per million, what exactly does that mean?
Well, that basically means that even a little bit of carbon in our atmosphere can result in very large shifts in our climate systems. And currently, we're at about 385 parts per million. So we're in that danger zone. And I think we're beginning to see that up here at 385 parts per million, there's already dramatic changes around the world, droughts in different parts, increased storm systems, the melting of the Arctic ice this summer. So recent science is really pointing to this 350 number as the safe limit of carbon dioxide that we need to get back to.
But when you say parts per million, is that per million what? Is that a measurement of air of some sort?
Yeah, it's for the total quantity of gases in the atmosphere. So
Okay.
A parts per million might not sound like a little bit, but it's enough to really tip the balance and cause a lot of disruption in our climate.
So what does 350.org do?
Well, 350.org does a lot of different things, but our real goal is to take this number 350, which, as you can tell, is a bit esoteric and scientific, and really popularize it in a way that will make it a meaningful target for people around the world. So we coordinate creative events all over the planet to get this 350 number out there and really try and spark an international movement that can get some grassroots energy going and convince our political leaders that 350 is the target we need to be shooting for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are some of the events that have been going on?
Well, you know, we've had a lot of stuff going on, actually, and we've just gotten going in the last few months, so it's been astounding to see the response from around the planet. We've had everything from farmers in Cameroon plant 350 trees to bikers in Salt Lake City, 350 bikers biking into downtown. All sorts of creative events people are doing to really get a movement going in their community, but also tied into this international narrative that we're telling about this global movement that's rising up for taking us to 350. But, you know, we're really just getting started. I think that one of the challenges we're facing and one of the challenges for all of us is how can we use these new technologies that are out there on the Internet to try and tie together a global movement to take on most global of problems.
Yeah, I saw your website and the nice little cartoon you have there that shows the number 350. So it seems that you're intentionally using things that can be understood by all languages?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a big challenge, as you know, there are thousands of languages in the world, and actually it's fading quickly. But we really want to honor the fact that people have different ways of communicating about these important issues, but at the same time, try and find some common ground. So our website is translated into 10 different languages right now, including English. But we're also really trying to experiment with what are ways that we can get this message across and create some common ground without language, with video and photos. So we did an introductory animation to this 350 idea about the importance of the 350 target and also the importance of getting a movement going to take us back there. And we worked with a great animation firm called Free Range Studios, and our challenge to them was help us create a video without using any words. Help us get this 350 concept out there just with images, just with music and sound. And we think they were highly successful, so I recommend people checking it out.
Yeah, I would agree.
But that's just one of the challenges we're facing and really having a lot of fun with. How can we creatively spread a message around the world that will almost transcend language?
Okay, so how is carbon emissions measured? What do people do to get a sample of air? I'm using the scientific end of this because I often hear about carbon emissions, but I don't exactly know, so I'm personally curious.
Sure. Yeah. That's a great question. And, you know, one of the goals of our project is to do some public education about, you know, where do all of these targets come from? What are all of these numbers floating around that we hear about? So when it comes to measuring carbon in the atmosphere, there are basically stations set up all around the world, the most famous of which is on Mauna Loa, the volcano in Hawaii. And people might recognize that from Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, and he talks a fair amount about the Mauna Loa Observatory. But what these stations do is they sample the air all over the world and basically come up with a global average of how much carbon is in the atmosphere. And as people know, there are a variety of greenhouse gases that cause global warming, everything like methane and other even more potent greenhouse gases. But the reason we have a target that talks about carbon dioxide is that carbon is really what scientists use to measure how global warming is progressing. And they do that in a variety of ways, but perhaps the most accurate and the one that people might have heard of and will hear more about is using ice core samples. So people go up to the Arctic and a variety of other places and measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the ice over the period of thousands and thousands of years. And what they've concluded is that, you know, humanity, the air conditions that allowed us to evolve, we're all in this range around 350 parts per million or below. That's really the safe upper limit for humanity. And only in the last about 30 years we surpassed that. We are creeping up about 2 parts per million a year and rapidly going up. And as we do, what happens is we begin to trigger some of these tipping points in the environment that lead to even more global warming. And so no one really knows, you know, what exactly global warming will cause, what exactly the effects will be. But we do know that we want to get back to this 350 number as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I'm also aware in the Arctic, there's also big deposits of methane that could cause quite a bit of trouble. Is that something that gets measured too? Is that something that can get measured?
Definitely. And that's one of the things that scientists are really worried about is, you know, what are these tipping points that are out there? You know, when we think about global warming, people often talk about this idea of a tipping point. In reality, there are many tipping points. There are many systems in our environment that we could trigger that would cause even more of a rapid increase in global warming. And one of those has to do with methane, and both in the Arctic and really, the big issue people are looking at is the kind of tundra in Siberia that stores a lot of methane because of the plant matter that's been dissolving over there over the centuries. And so the metaphor that we sometimes use to talk about 350 is the idea of cholesterol, that, you know, if you go to the doctor and you get a high cholesterol reading, it doesn't mean you're going to tip over and die the next day or have a heart attack, but it does put you in that danger zone where certain things could happen that would really be catastrophic to your health. And so now that we're over 350, it doesn't mean the planet's going to keel over and die and burn up in a flash, but that we're really in that zone right now in terms of the environment where any one of these tipping points, whether it's methane or the health of our rainforests or the acidity of our oceans, any one of those things is really more likely to tip over. And so we don't want to stay above this 350 number for too long, and our real goal is to get us back there as quickly as possible.
Now, how can an individual keep track of their carbon emissions?
Well, there are a variety of tools out there, and I can sort of point to a few. There's a number of carbon calculators online. If people Google that phrase, carbon calculator, you'll come up with a number of organizations which have developed a way to keep track of your own personal emissions. But our campaign is really focused more on what we can do as citizens, not just as individuals, but as citizens of our own individual countries and as citizens of the world. So our focus is more on political action and really saying that making changes in your personal life is essential. It's really important. But you also need to get together with your community and start really making political changes as well and engaging our public officials. Because 350 isn't a target really for us individually. It's a global target. It's one that we can only work together towards as a global community. So what our website and what our campaign does is encourage people to think of, what are some creative ways that I can get my friends together or my community together to get this message out there and have a lot of fun doing it. So as much as it's important to make individual actions, taking political action is just as important, if not even more important, at this kind of late hour of when we need to deal with global warming.
And how old is this company?
We just got going, actually. We just launched this January, and since then I've been trying to work out all the kinks of our website and see how we can run this campaign in a lot of different languages.
Yes.
And really just talking with people, calling organizations up and emailing organizations all over the world to get a sense of, you know, what's going on in Venezuela on climate? What are people doing in the Democratic Republic of the Congo? You know, how can we dialogue with activists in Vietnam and Southeast Asia? And it's been a fascinating experience and really, really motivating to hear that in all these different countries there's little things that are happening. So we've only been around for a few months, and those few months have really been spent kind of just gathering data and trying to see what's happening out there. And this fall and into next year, we'll really be kicking up and trying to unite some of these different efforts and see what we can do together.
Hmm. Is one of the goals to have a bit of a forum for countries or people to just see? Because that would be really interesting to be able to go to a site and learn about what other countries are doing, you know?
Definitely. Well, you know, that's what we thought, too. We kind of looked out there and we said, you know, we know that there's a movement out there. We hear little bits and pieces about what's happening around the world to fight global warming, but sometimes it's really difficult to track it down and know what's happening and to hear it from the people themselves. So one of our goals with the project is to share a lot of photos and video and blog posts on our website from different organizations and also just different individuals that are living with climate change all over the planet. So we're beginning to do that, and there's some videos on our website. I was recently in China, actually traveling there, working with a variety of environmental groups. So there's some YouTube videos that we made about what's happening in China right now, and we hope to be doing a lot more of that over the coming months.
Oh, well, that's very exciting. Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
Sure. I think that one of the things that we're experimenting with, and one of the things that we need everybody's help experimenting with, is how can we use these new online tools to create this global movement? I mean, this sort of thing simply wasn't possible 10 years ago and probably wasn't even possible a few years ago. But now with, you know, YouTube and blogs and Flickr and all these tools out there, there's so many ways for us to communicate and collaborate with people all across the planet. And our hope is that people will kind of join us in this experiment of how we can connect and how we can work together. You know, we're not a traditional organization. We're a small operation, really web-driven, and we rely on members and supporters all over the planet to help us figure out these challenges and help us find better ways to work together. So I encourage people to kind of check out our site and definitely get in touch with us and see how we can collaborate and see how we can really take these tools that are out there and hopefully build a global movement as quickly as possible.
Okay. One thing that actually comes to mind just now is Avez.org, and so they're doing a similar type of thing, but just for the purpose of polling or pressuring groups. Is that one of the inspirations behind this organization? Has Avez been a sort of an inspiration?
Yeah, no, Avez is a big inspiration
for
ours.
Yes.
And actually, our group that's working on 350 ran a campaign in the United States last year called Step It Up, which was just U.S.-focused because we really felt that, you know, our Congress, needed to take action, that we hadn't done a lot on global warming. And we worked really closely with Avez, and we actually launched around the same time in the same month. So we've always kind of been friends with those guys and seen what they're doing. And so when we were working on Step It Up, what we were trying to experiment with is how can we kind of use the Internet to be really community-driven, really offline actions. So we did a big day of action in the U.S. where we had a 1,400 events around the country in all 50 states, where we were using these online tools to give people the power to register an event in their community, build up an email list, post messages, download materials, and then finally upload a photo of their rally or their event to our website. And really, we were able to stitch all these photos from around the country together in this great mosaic of actions all over the place. And the reason I kind of bring that up is because what we're working on in trying to take these tools to create offline action fits really well with what Avez is doing. They're kind of the masters of using online tools to drive petition signatures and offline action. So we're really talking a lot with those guys back and forth about, you know, how can we take what you're experimenting with, these online tools and petitions and all of that, and the incredible membership that they've grown. I mean, they've got almost 3 million members in just a few, 18 months of being out there. So they're one of the largest organizations on the planet right now when it comes to advocacy. How can we take that experience and really tie it in with what we're trying to do with using those online tools for offline action, where people are actually organizing real-world events in their communities? And so I think it's a partnership that we're really excited about, and one of the many partnerships which I think are possible now with all these different groups that are experimenting with new technology and seeing how that fits into really doing effective advocacy on the ground and united on the ground in different countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for
thanks a lot.
Spending some time with us today. So this is Jamie of 350.org talking with us on sustainable futures. Well, thank you for tuning in again this week. My parting word is to come and check out the Sustainable SFU Festival happening this Wednesday at Simon Fraser University. It was a very, very great festival last year, and this year is looking to be even better. So if you're at Simon Fraser University this coming Wednesday, anytime during the day, do check out the wonderful Sustainability Festival that will be happening. I have been Ryan Fletcher, and will continue to be Ryan Fletcher. I am wishing you a sustainable future.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.